This episode is made possible by Sandra Oyewole, partner at Olajide Oyewole LLP, and Ajibola Olomola, partner at KPMG Nigeria. Hello and welcome to the SNC podcast, a show helping you better understand the intriguing world of music, arts, and entertainment through insightful discussions with African artists, creatives, executives, and entrepreneurs. I am your host, Fola Shade Anozie. On the show with me today is Amanda Uzoagba. She's an entertainment and intellectual property lawyer, creative business consultant, and educator. Amanda is a senior legal executive at Ebony Life Limited. She's passionate about educating creators and entertainers about their intellectual property rights, and she drives conversations on this topic through her social media platforms. She's also the award-winning author of Let's Dance, a deep dive into the dance industry, founder of the Dear Creator podcast, and co-host of the Legal Avenue podcast. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Hi, Fola Shade.
First of all, I have to say thank you so much for your patience.
Thank you for having me.
It's a rainy day. You could have been drinking tea.
I could have been chilling.
I know. And you got here early and, you know, we're still setting up. But thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to say happy belated World International Property Day. I think it was last week.
Yeah, last week.
Yeah, April 26th, Abby.
Yes.
And the theme of the show, theme of World IP Day was... Yes. Women and IP, yes. And accelerating creativity and innovation.
Yeah.
And as an enterprising woman and entertainment lawyer who's, as I said in my intro, is doing really great work to empower creatives and entertainers, I celebrate you and I applaud you for all your amazing work. Now, you are an entertainment lawyer, but before you became an entertainment lawyer, you were working as a blogger and you were deeply interested in the media and entertainment space.
Yeah.
Now, I want to know, when did your interest in law start? Was it before you became a blogger, or was after? After, or maybe was doing your experience as a blogger that you now said, oh, I actually want to go down this legal path?
Okay, so I became a blogger in uni. So I was already a law student when I became a blogger. So when I was doing it, I didn't really like put it side by side with entertainment law. Entertainment law wasn't like a big deal back then. When I was a student, it wasn't like a thing that students could discuss as an area of law. It's either corporate or litigation. Mm-hmm. And that was it. So when I was doing it out of passion because I wasn't sure if I wanted to practice law yet. I was sure that I wasn't a big fan of litigation. I was like, okay, corporate or something in the media. I've always been attracted and drawn to the media and entertainment space. So then it was when Lindy KG blog started raining very well.
Yeah.
Yes. My mom was like, you can be a blogger too and make a lot of money. Yes. So that's when I started blogging, process of blogging. I got into the media and entertainment space. They're doing PR for record labels and all that. So I did that on its own, trying to understand my path in life, whether I was going to do law or I was going to be a media practitioner. But by the time I finished law school, finished NYSC, and I started looking deeply into, okay, yes, you might want to practice law, find a comfortable area of law for you, something that will mix with your passion so you could enjoy. Because one thing that was very important to me growing up and going through my journey is finding something that I love.
Mm.
So I don't feel frustrated or feel like, oh, I'm just going through this cycle because I need to make money and adulthood. So by the time I came out during that small phase of NYSC and finding a job, that's when I discovered entertainment law.
Okay.
That's
really good.
Exactly. So I was like, oh, this is the best thing that could happen to me.
This is
law and entertainment I obviously love. So let's get it.
So why did you now choose to stop blogging? Because you could have still been doing that on the side.
Yeah. Sincerely, I stopped blogging because I didn't want it to affect my law school. So law school was a lot and blogging was a lot. So blogging, you need to be on your toe, like the news. Your blog doesn't need to be lacking behind.
Yeah.
And back then, you're like, you're looking at this person, looking at this person. Yeah. You're gathering news and all of that. And when I entered law school, I tried finding someone that would do it, but I couldn't find someone that would do it as well as I was doing it. So the plan was just pause it for 1 year, focus on law school, pass that hurdle, because this is a journey I already started 5 years ago. So it won't make sense that I'm now putting it at risk because of bloggers. So I was like, okay, I can always come back to this. But then law school started, finished, life just kept going from law school, court bar. Next to your parents are like, so what are you doing with your life?
Time to get married.
Do you understand?
Yeah,
so it wasn't something like I chose to say, okay, I'm stopping, I'm done blogging. You know, it was supposed to be a pause and come back, but I never found my way back. I found something better. Let me put it that way.
That's great. Yes. And I know that you had read your story about how you got your job at Ebony Life.
Yeah.
And you said it took you 3 tries.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned that you were happy that they didn't take you on the first try. Mm-hmm. Can you share a bit about that?
So I'm more of a media person than a law person. So by the time I was done with NYSC, I looked at my CV. I had a lot of media experience and non-legal experience. Like, think about it. I've done a lot of things outside the legal space. But then when you come to like finding a job and all of that, so I was like, okay, let me see if I could find something still in the media space. So when I approached the whole Ebony Life work the first time, I saw it as a pathway to get into maybe TV presenting and other areas of media. Mm-hmm. So I can remember vividly during one of my interviews, they asked me, I should ask them any question they have. I think like that question I asked them is a low for them. Like, that's the main reason why they didn't employ me. Nobody can tell me otherwise. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, so as a lawyer, if sometimes there's nobody on set or TV presenter is late, can they ask you to step in and do the job? So I left.
They were like, this wants to be in front of
me. I left asking questions about what they were going to employ me to do. And I was already looking like, okay, this could be another way out or way into this. So when I look back at the journey, I'm like, okay, thank God I actually didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Because it gave me room to find entertainment law. I still did the whole TV presenting thing, mm-hmm. 2019 ending. And got to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm done with this phase. I've scratched that itch. Mm-hmm, if that's a thing, mm-hmm. I'm done. Now it's time for me to focus mm-hmm. on law.
Yeah. And you had talked about, I think you said, when you left that interview, you realized that you needed to empower yourself mm-hmm. and become more involved in the legal space. Can you talk about some of the things that you actually did to empower yourself?
Okay, so that wasn't like an immediate thing.
Awareness.
It was like a 6 months thing, because I went home and then the rejection as well as some other ones came in, and I was like, okay, so I need to, if the job is not coming, I need to create it for myself. So all this while, back when I was a blogger and everything, I did it for myself till they came. So I have to at least put the step, like put my leg out. I understand I don't have so much legal experience, so I don't even blame them for not looking my way. So let me give them the reason to know that I know my stuff. So that was what was behind my mind. So literally what I did was, that was the period I found out about entertainment law. Even while I was interviewing, when I interviewed everybody in life first, I just knew it was corporate practice, in-house law. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was a thing like entertainment law. So it was within that 6 months break that I found out there was a thing like entertainment law. So I started reading a lot of articles, online contents. I reached out to Akiemi. I swear to you, tomorrow we always crack up about that. I reached out to you, told you how I was about to leave law, and every reached out to my team. Okay, so this area of law that I found interesting, and I would like for you to mentor me. Then there was this other lady, Juliana. She works with WIPO now.
Okay.
She has mad content. That was the first time I was being introduced to music publishing, music licensing. I consumed her videos. Then there's this guy on YouTube, God on Fire Mark. He has lot of content around entertainment law. Yes. So I was on it back to back. I think I consumed a lot of content and a lot of online information to the point that they're still contradicting themselves. Mm. So that's when I always tell people, consume as much as you can till it gets to the point that you're contradicting yourself. Like what you read there, what you read there doesn't add up. Then you're now going to the field and find out the answer. So whenever I got to that point, I then reach out to lawyers and like, okay, in this situation, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So I think I was a bit too bold, because if I think back now, if I was being cautious, most things I did to like come out as an entertainment lawyer and empower myself, I wouldn't have. I would have just studied, learned, and then go backwards and start applying for jobs. I didn't do that.
Yeah.
Within a month, I put out a flyer that was doing free contract review for people. And this was literally 1 month into saying I'm going to entertainment law practice.
Yeah.
So I was literally learning, this is something that most people don't know. I was literally learning as I was reading your contract, because I wasn't getting the jobs. I know the industry. I understood the industry. I've been in the industry. But the legal aspect of it, at that point, I hadn't gotten the opportunity to actually learn on the field. After I did that and I got people to come in, I was still learning. So sometimes if I go through a contract that something is confusing, I'll reach out to a lawyer and like, so this is the fix. I mean, what do you think about this? So I did better. So entertainment law doesn't exist in the East. So as at then, it didn't exist.
Because that's where you're coming from, the East,
I'm
right?
I'm coming to from Lagos. The East. I grew up in Enugu.
Yeah.
I moved to Lagos, like, this is my third year in Lagos. So I was coming from the East. I was in the East when I started practice. So I was like, okay, I have this little knowledge. If I start sharing it, it will seem a lot to these people. So if I could package myself there, coming to Lagos and now saying, oh, this is who I am, it won't be like I'm trying to impose or say, you know, the whole imposter syndrome, like, oh, you're not who you say you are.
I love that. So there's obviously lessons of empowering yourself.
Yeah.
Don't just sit down and cry and say the world hates me. And obviously the importance of strategy.
You're
very strategic.
Empowering yourself is like the main thing, because it got to a point that I now start getting DMs from other lawyers. Some of them law firms, we have an opening. Strangely, the other two times that I tried out with Ebony Life was not me just popping up at seeing a vacancy. My present head of department now, the second time, reached out to me via Instagram. I was like, oh, I see what you're doing as an entertainment lawyer. I admire it and all of that. There's an opening. If you're interested, apply for it. So if I hadn't empowered myself, if I hadn't put myself out there, I wouldn't have been able to tell them, this is what my worth is, this is what I can do. And then the jobs kept coming.
Yeah, that's amazing, Amanda. Thank you for sharing that story. And I hope it encourages someone who's watching or listening, you know.
Yeah.
Now, you obviously talked about how you were working as a PR person for record labels. Now, we hear lots of stories about record labels using streaming farms to inflate artist streaming numbers. And you also hear about them forcing artists down our throats through different mediums. But my question is, a lot of artists end up choosing to go independent. And when they go independent, they realize that maybe the love that I was receiving is not genuine and it's organic. And a lot of them are really shocked. Wasn't I popular or popping, or wasn't my music embraced by lots of people? So I want to get your perspective and advice or thoughts for people who are on record labels, artists, and maybe they are new or they're inexperienced, or maybe they've been there for quite a while. How should they approach public relations? So if you could share like your thoughts on that.
So I think both parts is like, the artists need to work with the record label. At the same time, they need to do something for themselves. Because what happens in the industry a lot is that you see artists hands off and say, oh, my label is going to do this. My label is out there partying, or she's out there partying and doing other things. And then they have other artists. The sooner it doesn't, it's normal. If you see someone that is serious about themselves and they're working on themselves and they're putting themselves out there, you'll be happier to encourage the person than when the person is like, oh, when I put this out there, you guys should consume it. I just can't sleep. Your lover will be like, oh, when you're serious, let me know. It's not me that will stress myself on top of something that you don't consider important to you. So I think the advice I would give artists as to PR and how the public perceives them and all that is work closely with your record label, and at the same time record labels listen to the artists. It has to be a two-way street, because then it's business. Most artists miss that part. They get sentimental about this. Oh, when I was on my own, you promised this, you promised me that, you promised that this will happen. It's business. Be realistic. Leave sentiment apart. Look at things, all the things they're promising you, all the things that you're going to get, fine, that is that. But what can you give them back? It's a business. They're putting money, they have to get something back. So if they're telling you, oh, we need you to act like a bad boy, that's the image you want. Because that was a part of PR I was very involved in, working with the A&R department and also working with the media. So A&R department, you already know, those are the guys that prep, scout, get talent, them ready for the public. So, and one thing I kept noticing was there was no direct communication, or there was no clear communication as to what role that you are playing. So most times, the artist that we see outside is a persona, is what they've packaged you to see, because that's what will sell the music faster. They are a product. But then, it's more like they're forcing it down on them. And that's why it's easy for them to report online, to be as if, oh, so what are we doing? So work closely. Both parties need to communicate and understand each other. At the same time, artists, don't be so emotional. Artists are so down. Artists don't be too emotional. It's a business that you get. Yes, be emotional. It's your music, it's your talent, it's all that. But put that aside and do it as a business. This is what can sell. But at the same time, record labels should be able to give the artists options to be able to pick and be comfortable in the persona. Now, most of the artists, when they leave, the reason why it's hard for them is that most times the clout you get is because of the environment you're in. It's because of the crowd you go with. So if obviously you're signed under a certain record label that already has its own, whether you're good or you're not good, people that like that label automatically want to hear what you have to say. But the moment you're out, and it's obvious that you're out, it's now left on your talent. You need to prove that you can actually do it.
Shouldn't you have been proving that talent while you were there so that...
That's what I'm saying. Some of them do.
Yeah,
some don't.
Yeah.
So those that don't, or those that feel they've done it enough and they can stand on their own, they might be that talented, but talent can only take you
so far.
You need talent. You need money. You even need God's grace. There are a lot of things that come into play. So most times when they leave... They're like, most of them get overwhelmed at the bills and expenses. They're like, wait. I thought I just need to record music and that is all. No. Some of them I get overwhelmed about the whole streaming numbers. Yes, the streaming firms exist. Probably they do. I can't confirm or deny that. Mm-hmm. But definitely we know that all those streaming numbers are influenced by a lot of things, especially clout. There are a lot of songs we listen to now. It's not as if we're listening to them because we like them, because of the artist, because of the label. So if you've not developed yourself up to that extent, and you're not standing on your own, and you're standing on your own, and it's not clear that you left the label on a goodwill. It's like you're fighting with them. Artists need to take PR more seriously. Understand that public perception is not like, oh, I am who I am. Take me as I am.
Yeah.
You're a product. You're trying to get people to buy you. So while you're trying to get people to buy you, you need to convince them on why they should bank on you.
Because I was about to say, like, you know, a lot of artists hate when you say that they're a product, you know. They're like, I'm a human being, I don't want to be a product, you know. But I guess they're intertwined, you know. You're a product, you know. It's like you're a product, you're selling something while you're selling.
You have moments where you be a product, and you have moments where you be a human being.
Yeah.
When you're supposed to be a product, be a really good product. And when you have to be a human being, be a really good, relatable human being.
I love that. Now, as a senior legal executive at Ebony Life, can you talk about what your work entails?
So Ebony Life Limited, although not officially known as Ebony Life Group, has a lot of companies under, and it's one legal department that oversees everything. So we're into movie production, we're into school education with Ebony Life Creative Academy, we're into hospitality with White Orchid Hospitality, Turaka, Ebony Life Cinema. We are into distribution for movies and all of that. And we have other companies outside Nigeria. So the thing is, my day to day, when I joined the company, truthfully, between me and you, I thought it was just going to be movie production. I think when they give you a JD, actually read it to the last full stop. Don't assume things. Yeah. So when I came in, and then I had to learn on spot that my day to day doesn't just cover entertainment law. I do entertainment law, I do corporate, I do sometimes land related hospitality. So my day-to-day as a lawyer has to do with contract drafting, contract review, reviewing a lot of contracts. And trust me, you can jump from production to insurance in 30 minutes and you just have to switch in your brain that you're done with entertainment law. And then it has to do with clearance, third party, that's when we're into production. When you're into production, management of risk, legal risks that could come up. Oh, has this been done? Has that been done? Getting licensing, ensuring that, like I said, the hospitality part of business could be demanding. Certain licenses you need to get, certain inspections that need to happen, and all of that. You need to always know at some point, because Lagos State government don't joke. Like, they'll come and just stamp something in front of you. And for that, I mean, it's a serious issue. So literally, that's my day-to-day everyday life work.
So do you sometimes go on set? You know, back to your point about, like, sometimes, do you?
So, you're not needed to go on set. Mm. You could go on set, but we have busy the office get. We are not a large team. We're really little, like a really good team. So, we are almost always busy, especially doing production. Because even when you're not on set, a lot of things are coming in. Oh, this location just popped up. We need it. We need to send out these letters. We need to send out this agreement. We need to do this. We need to do that. So, I've been opportunity to be on set, I think, once or twice. And it's beautiful. And it's something, if you find your time, if you find time to do it, go on set. But the issue is finding time to do it.
Yeah.
You're allowed to, but it's not like a must. You must not be there. And because there's always that communication between the team, the crew, and you.
Yeah. And just sometimes lawyers go on set and they're able to catch maybe an issue happening and they're able to, like, put a stop to it quickly.
Very good, important reason why you need to go on set, because sometimes things come back after and it's not like, oh, why didn't you tell us that this happened? Oh, this happened.
Exactly.
Oh, this vehicle that we leased, our license, this happened. Insurance related issue. So yes, it's necessary, it's important,
but
that if there's a project, be on set as often as you can to see the things that are happening and trying to, like, avoid them from happening on on the spot.
Yeah.
But most times we don't have time to do that.
Okay. Now, sticking with your job description, what are some of the clauses that you're seeing in contracts that maybe either creatives or actors are failing to pay attention to? Like, similar to what you said about your JD, I didn't read it, right? So are there some clauses that you're seeing that creatives and entertainers are failing to, maybe even actors, you know, are failing to pay attention to?
Within the film industry.
Within the film industry.
Okay. So I'll say the ones that are failing to notice, as well as the ones that you're trying to cost me my job.
No,
as well as
so specific.
few of the ones that I've seen some include over time. So I think two important clauses that most actors don't notice, because truthfully, except if you have a lawyer, they just go through, these are dates we need, you're needed on set, this rehearsal, this photo shoot, this is the total fee we're paying you, this is your total time, and they're good. Just so most times they don't get to understand or notice the marketing and promotion clause, that certain weeks, depending on your hierarchy and cast list, and depending on if you're a major or minor cast, certain weeks after the project or after the project has been released, you need to actively do this. It's more like you're back on the employment of the company. There's a proper, like, my company can go mad on PR. There's a proper strategy for you, like this day one, day two, day three, day three, what they are supposed to do. So sometimes the people that are not used to it, some of the guys that are like big in the industry, they already know what's up, don't have any issue. But some of these newcomers, when they see, they're like, oh, I thought I'm done with this project. No, it's out. It's time to promote it. So most times they don't notice that. Another thing that I think they don't notice is, for example, I don't know if all production companies do that, but I know major production companies do that, to include clauses saying that you cannot change your appearances or do certain things to your appearance while you're in an active project.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, normally, the contracts, most of them, this is not me signifying to how certain companies contracts are, but most times contracts are not exclusive. So you have actors that can be on three sets or two sets. We're just saying first priority, you have to be here when we need you. You have to prioritize us. So imagine a situation where you take another job.
Yeah.
And in this job, you're not supposed to have mustache, and now you're supposed, or maybe you have mustache on a normal day and it's good, but so you have to shave all of that. Yeah. And then you forget and you shave all of them.
Yeah.
So that appearance,
that's amazing. That's
a lot of people don't get to notice that. Now, two points or two clauses that I've seen certain actors include that I feel could be beneficial for other actors, especially depending on where you've gotten to in the industry. One is, some of them actually negotiate or insist on the positioning of their name on the promotion materials, flyers, everything. My name has to be there. My picture has to be there.
Not standard, though.
No, it's not. It's not standard. Yeah. So out of the main, this main cast, depending on the type of movie, if it's like a family movie, they could have like major family on the flyer. But if it's like all these trailers or just focusing on two or three people, it's just those two or three people that are there. But it could be a major cast. Just that. So you can insist that, okay, one promotion material has to at least show me, has my name on it. My name has to be here, my title, main title or not, and all that. Now, mind you, it's not you say it and the company has to. Most times, all of these are at discretion of the company. But depending on how big you are in the industry, it's something that you could negotiate with the company that I've seen happen. Then another thing is welfare of actors. So a lot of actors just assume that, number one, it depends. If you've worked with a lot of major production companies, they just assume that your welfare has to be taken care of. Hotel will be gotten for them, their feeding, their transportation will be taken care of. So it's more like, oh, how far you not come on set? You're like, oh, you would not tell me the hotel I'm sleeping in. You guys never checked me in. And that's not the case. Then for those people that are already used to, that have been in the industry for a long time, that are used to the old Nollywood system, who practically fly from wherever they are and come and meet you and shoot for how much money and then go home, and they are cool with it. So depending on the budget of the movie, depending on the type of movie, depending on production company, you could find a way to make your commute, the job, you working on the project easier for you. So we've had in the past actors that could ask, okay, is there a location being made available? And if there's no location being made available, that could reflect on the whole late coming clause, because most contracts do have a late coming clause where if you're late by some certain hours, they start deducting your fee. So if you're staying very far and they are not making arrangement for hotel, then indirectly you need to negotiate that particular clause in a way that it fits you or it to be okay for everybody. Do you get it? If not, it has to be agreed. Maybe you get a hotel and they can pay certain bills for you. Some production companies will lodge all the main cast probably together with the crew or different from the crew, there's transportation, there's food on set. So all those welfare, okay, while you're on set, can you bring your assistants? Some is a closed set, you can't bring anybody from outside. But if you don't know this, you start having issue on the day you're supposed to be on set. Oh, my assistant is supposed to come with me, she cannot go anywhere, I'm not going to. And that will be an issue. So those are certain clauses that...
Those are super insightful. When I said, isn't that standard, I meant that... Shouldn't people already know? But I think a lot of times, knowledge is power. Yeah. And if you don't know stuff, then we end up leaving stuff on the table.
And then again, it depends on... So we all understand that we are in one Nollywood, but there are different levels. So it depends on where you've been. So I don't say... I'm going to say... You've been at Asaba Nollywood for a long time, and then you're moving to the major players. There are certain things, just because you're looking for the opportunity, there are certain things that you let slip by, or you not know that those people that have been on this level all this while are actually enjoying this, and you could ask for this, and you could actually negotiate this. Mm-hmm. So that's where that comes in. But you see those guys that have been up there for a while, they know what's up.
Yeah, and that's why people, they need lawyers like you, right? Look at me hyping you. Now, I want to talk a bit about story rights, right? And why it's important. I'm sure you've seen the feedback that people have, not feedback, comments around Linda Cage's Dark October. And I think a lot of the issues centered around that she didn't allegedly get consent or didn't consult with the parents of the deceased children. And some people mentioned that, well, it's a public story, right? So why does she require consent? Can you speak about that? And why is it important, if the story is in the public domain, does the filmmaker need to consult with either the subjects or the family of the late subjects in this situation?
Yeah. So generally, if the subject is dead and you're sticking to information that the public knows, like you're not going to the family or going to close family friend to get information that is hidden, it's public information, just that you decided to make it into a movie, you consulting with the family is just at your own goodwill. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to. Now, I think there was a project that I handled independently, and then by the time the producers put out word that, oh, we're making this into a movie, the family reached out to me. I was like, oh, can we get to this? You need to speak to us first. And we're like, okay, we can set it up, but there was a bit back and forth, and we couldn't set it up. And then family stepped right up, oh, you know, you cannot do this story that... Or like, we actually can. The fact that we agreed to like sit down with you is like, oh, let everybody be happy.
It's
courtesy. So when the movie exactly cuts, to say, in case the production come out, there will not be any bad blood. Everybody can promote it and be happy. Because if it's promoted in unison, it's more money that will be made. So you're not obligated to. Now, if the information you're getting has to do with, like, you have to go to the family and get some certain information that involve family members are still alive, then you need to actually inform them. It's like release forms. You need to clear with those ones that are alive, or clear with those certain information that is not in public domain. Say, for example, you want to talk about someone that police killed. And then in process of you doing that, you found out that, okay, back at home, the guy is a cultist, but nobody knew. Or maybe the guy is gay, but nobody knew. And you have an angle that you want to explore that story on. Focused on that, and you know, once you start digging into that, it's going to open a lot of unknown information, and you found out you need to actually like speak to them about it, because it's the son's story. No, so general rule is, if you are alive, you need to come to you to take permission. If you're dead and it's public information, you can shoot the movie, you can do the production.
Okay. Yeah. So you don't think she did anything?
You
can choose not to answer that.
I'm not answering from a legal perspective. Okay. I'm not going to talk about this as an individual, as a human being, as a consumer. And this is me being sentimental. So it's a sad story. And no matter how much you want to paint it, it's a story that I believe even the family will want to forget. So you doing that without speaking to them about it, it's like someone opening up old wounds and traumas that you have, and you have to relive it all over again when you're trying to move on with your life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, my belief is that it's not all stories that must be told. There are just some stories that are too hard to be told, especially when the time between when it happened and now has not been so far apart. If it's like a time where, okay, 20 years down the line, 30 years down the line, maybe after the uncles and the fathers and mothers have all died, and maybe it's just generation that has basic knowledge and you're trying to like inform them and tell them this happened, everybody be careful, that'll be a different situation. But they're still alive. and you don't have their consent. Really, they need to be comfortable with it. This is me just speaking as
a human consumer, being,
and being sentimental. They need to be okay with it for you to tell the story of their kids and have them relive that trauma all over again. Yeah.
That makes sense. And for people who don't know what Dark October is, it was a Nigerian real life film, which is a real life story of four young men, Alu boys, who were lynched to death because they were falsely accused of stealing money. So, I mean, it's still fresh.
Like, I can remember when it happened. So when I saw it, it was like mixed emotions about it. But then it's out.
Yeah. Well, lesson learned. And thank you for the insightful information. Yeah. Now, you're the author of Let's Dance. I want to get this right. It's a guide to making money, managing intellectual property, and understanding the issues in the dance industry. Can you talk a bit about the book? Because I know you used to be a dancer, but what made you want to write this book?
Okay, I'll be as sincere as, I don't know what that sincerity is going to cost me, but I'll be very sincere. I didn't have plans of writing that book. I was just going to write an article. So I have a lot of friends like within academies. My mom is a lecturer, so she has always been pushing me to write. But that aside, during COVID, I had friends that were writing articles. And one of them was like, okay, so you know entertainment law practice. Leave the whole online content creation. Write articles that people can actually read, something that can be documented. In case tomorrow Instagram shut down, you still have proof that, okay, this information is out there. I was like, okay, fine. I'm going to write on the dance industry. So when I picked it up because there were not a lot of people talking. There was nobody talking about it. So I was like, okay, music is already overflogged. Art, to an extent, I still have like my gray areas with art. So I was like, let me not speak so much and then expose my ignorance about that area. So I was like, let me go into an area that I understand from both perspectives, being a lawyer and being a former dancer. Now, the more I researched about it, especially learning the international standings and the laws and everything, and then seeing what we have here, I was just provoked to write a book. I said, like, from middle of the book to the end to the front. So I was just randomly putting together chapters till the book came on. I think still during that COVID or before COVID, I'm not really sure of the time, there was this dancer, she's Nigerian born, but she's based, I think I'd be UK based, UK born, but Nigerian, she's from Benin, Easy. She came out online. I was like kind of ranting that a certain, it has passed, so I'm not going to try and mention the artist, but a certain female artist employed her to do choreography, and then credit wasn't given, she was not paid well enough or something like that, welfare wasn't really taken care of, her people had injuries, there was no insurance, hospital, and all of that. And then a lot of people were like, really, it's not just dance, what do people want? And then I realized that people don't understand what goes into dancing. Like, a lot goes into it. Literally breaks your body, your bone, your soul to do it. So first of all, people see that, oh, I can dance, it's all fun and all of that. But when it crosses over to coming out with an entire routine, a choreography for a show, for a music video, is a lot. So I could relate to what she was talking about. So at first, when I saw that, I just saved videos. Like, I'm going to come back and do my research on what legal standings and legal laws, and sorry, what the law says about dance. And then I moved on. And during COVID, that one, this one I'm going to mention, was not Nigerian. When Beyonce's Lion King.
Go ahead.
So there was this dancer, Georgina, also,
that
came online. I was talking about how she was part of the dancers and they never told them that it was for a movie. It's not, was it Lion King? I mean, something King, Black King or something.
Black is King.
Black is King. That they never told them it's for a movie, that they told them that they are just shooting for a music video, and because of it, they didn't negotiate high enough fees and certain things, this, that. So she was asking that, okay, lawyers should please, like, if there are lawyers around that knows how to deal with this. So I spoke with her. She gave me some of the inside gist, which I cannot say because it's not like in general public, about the whole thing. But I think in the process, they settled outside court, because at some point she was like, oh, we've settled, there's no need for noise. But that also sparked the interest again. I was like, I went back to the video because I saved Izzy's own video. I went back to it and I watched it. I was like, okay, so we have welfare, we have credits, credit is somehow linked to intellectual property, we have insurance, welfare, then we have you paying enough. I'm like, okay, I might not be able to talk so much about payment part, because when I was a dancer, it wasn't like we are just going into that phase where we are being paid to dance and perform. When I took a step back, I was already entering my final year.
this was happening in the town my parents lived in. So I didn't want to be on one big stage and someone that knows my father would not call you. I'd be like, oh, I thought your daughter is studying law. What she did? So that was like my major reason. So I was like, okay, it's time to hang the boot. Just focus on your final year, graduate. And then if down the line you feel you want to do this on a professional, I never considered it on a professional level, but in case you want to, then you can always come back to it. So I was like, I can't speak so much about payment part, but part I can speak on are these other areas. So I started reaching out to certain dancers. So within that period, I don't know what happened, but somehow I got linked to Kaffi,
the dancer. Yeah.
And I think someone made a comment about her and I defended her. Unconsciously, she liked it and followed me. I followed her back. Then I sent her a DM. So I told her, oh, I was doing this research on this. And I asked her a few questions. She answered. I went back to Easy. So I just asked a few dancers that are like into it professionally now. So when I finished getting the basic information about what was going on to an extent in the industry, I was like, okay, now let me do my research. Before I wrote the book, I had a series for dancers. I don't know that a lot of people knew that, but I had like an email series for dancers where dancers signed up. So it was a free consultation with them getting free materials from me. And that process, I got to hear from what their issues were. So I was able to like segment it. Oh, this has to be talked about. This has to be talked about. This has to be talked about. Yeah. So the issues. And then that was when this game.
Okay, Mr.
There's this game, I'm trying to remember, I literally called the name this morning. There's this game that a lot of dancers abroad we are swinging.
Oh, Fortnite?
Yes, for the dance. So in the process of me researching, I said, I was like, beautiful. There's someone being taken to court for this, so I could hinge on this. Do you understand? Say that this is actually not theory, this is practice. Copyright wasn't like a big deal for dancers, but then when I spoke to them, it was more like, okay, so understanding you have a copyright. Obviously, you can't tell a music movie director or someone that, oh, I want to retain my copyright in dance. No, when you're doing that. But then if you're going to sign it over to them, that should affect your fee. You're not just giving them fee. For you, dance is now your fee plus assignment of your rights.
Yeah, because it's interesting that you said about that Beyonce thing. And yes. I don't know if you know her. I think her choreographer, Jaquel Knight. He copyrighted his Single Ladies. You know, because he's the one behind Single Ladies. Yeah. And if there's an article on Billboard that came out like 2020 during COVID, which is what I was like, oh, is that what you're talking about? Yeah, and it was super insightful. Like the whole process of how he went about it. Mm-hmm. Have you seen?
I think I read it briefly.
In past, I'm going to share it with you. Yeah. I just thought it was fascinating. Yes. You know, just like the whole process of how he's copywriting it and then eventually he wants to license it. Mm-hmm. Because he's like, why would music producers be making money on the back end and as a choreographer, you're not making it? Yeah. Yes. And you had mentioned that you wanted to get, your purpose of writing the book was you want to get African choreographers to look deeply into intellectual property in the dance industry.
Yes.
Can you share two tips that a dancer should be looking out for, maybe when you're contracted, should you insist on a contract? What did they say? You know, contract, how do you go about that? So if you just maybe share one or two tips.
So contract part, we obviously in the Nigerians, I'm not really big fans of contract. But
we are when it comes to international, but just with ourselves. Can we just make that clear?
With ourselves, we'll be like, oh, we're friends now. We know
you ourselves. Understand? We just meet that, I'm just like,
meet
why?
Back then, just
sorry, go on.
Then, when I was speaking to dancers, I kind of devised a means that if the person that is employing your services don't want a contract, you could actually pass your terms to them and then have it binding, including your invoice. Now, the issue is that before, when I was speaking to them, I realized that a lot of dancers, except those that already had international exposure, a lot of them, we are still treating it as, it's a hobby that I make money from. It's a hobby that makes money for me. Why have a proper 9-to-5? I have a proper business, so it's no big deal. Oh, Davido called me to dance. Oh, he's paying me this amount of money, I'll dance, and that is it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then a few that understood that it was business already had invoices. So I was like, you see those terms that you want? Impute it in your invoice. I'm not even insisting that you must tell them I want to retain my intellectual property. I don't think we're there yet. It's a thing of, let's all acknowledge the fact that there's copyright that exists first. And when we get to that stage of first accepting dancers to be proper professionals in the entertainment industry and the fact that they have rights, then we can now start talking about, should we protect those rights? Should we license those rights? Should we exploit those rights? So you could include it in invoice that, oh, these are terms for copyright, for assignment of copyright, an extra amount of money, welfare, your dancers has to be taken care of at this point. Sets cannot close 8. If any set that is above 8 p.m. or 9 p.m., accommodation and transportation. Because we had issues. I think I've forgotten who gave me the story, but we had issues where dancers were stranded on the road and nobody even cared to check up on them. So these are things that you could put in your invoice. If you put it in fine print and they don't see it, perfect.
But you know, I keep on saying that it really breaks my heart how we accept international standards when it comes to foreigners, but when our Nigerian brothers or African brothers are insisting on certain standards, we say, who are you to? And it just drives me mad. Like, the
it's modern slavery.
Yeah. It's self-loathing, we have.
It still comes back to that. We always feel that the white guys or the foreigners know more than us. So for them to say, oh, let's do it this way, sometimes they could be wrong. But when we see they're wrong, we're like, oh, this is a new right.
It's just,
so if they bring documents, oh, we must sign. Seriously, we're signing.
I'm just like, you know.
You know, a lot of issues we most of our A-list artists had at first when the likes of Sonny and all of these big guys were coming in because they were not reading the fine prints. They were so excited about, oh, international parties were involved in the entertainment industry and they were just signing on everything. So I think it's a slow phase.
Yeah.
We're getting to that point where we could say, okay, yes, I need a contract for this before I disburse funds. I need a contract for this before I actually start working.
I mean, you even with the dance, because I love dance and I love choreographers, which is why, like, when I saw that you had written, I was like, oh my God, you know? Because you see in the States, you have a lot of black creators that are not being credited for their dances, you know? So I just, when I saw that, I was like, that's amazing. And I want to talk to her about that. I think that people think that, like you said, it's dance. What is the big deal? Like, you can't make money from it. But if you're,
it's just, they are dancers, and who cannot, if they don't do, bring someone else that can dance on stage. And that's why I'm not trying to spoil anybody's hustle, but you see some people, rather than they pay a proper choreographer to do a dance routine for their dance videos, they go on street, pick boys, play the music and have them dance and they video it, and that is it. Those boys are happy. They're in an artist video. They post it up. They didn't give them credit for shame buying. They not say dancers, chuku, chuku, and make a good, this one. They not say anything, no credit. Some of them, they might even probably give them 5K or 10K or give them food. And they're happy. And that's, in a way, they not see it as a way to treat dancers. Oh, they're not serious. They're just dancers. And if they're dancing for fun. I'm not singing for fun.
Yeah, I think that I was about to say that it's been spiritual revival in this country. We're just drinking holy water. Because the way we treat each other, it just drives me mad. But I don't want to rant because I know you have to go. Now, as we move on to the fun random questions, I want to ask you to talk about your Dear Creator podcast and Legal Avenue podcast. Can you talk a bit about those two different podcasts?
So it was COVID. Dear Creator's podcast was COVID. COVID left us with a lot of time in our hands and nothing to do. And I was home. I was quarantining with my parents, my family. It was driving me nuts because it's been a long time that all of us, we are together in one house. So I think I saw it as a pathway for me to, like, still put out content. And again, a lot of things were happening online. You needed to be on Instagram to join in the conversation. So I was like, okay, let me start a podcast that if you don't have Instagram, if you don't want to go online, if you're trying to put yourself social media-wise, you can actually go on AudioMac, go on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, any platform and listen to it. So I literally started recording it in my house. And the whole idea for Dear Creators podcast, which I really hope I continue.
I was to say that, you know, Amanda, but go ahead.
The main idea for it was tell stories that had happened to my clients. These guys, obviously, I can't say, oh, Mr. A didn't know. And then give you real life stories of what's happening. Because when I said that first, I had a client, I think I'm one of my first clients. She signed a contract of 13 years. She had no idea. When I was trying to get out of the contract, her boss said, oh, there's nothing like entertainment law. Are you sure that lawyer even passed law school?
13 years.
13 years. That's what she signed. So I think that and other stories that I heard during the consulting period, because when I put out free consultation, a lot of people came through. So I heard a lot of things. So I was like, okay, let me put out the story. So the outline of the podcast was tell the story, say what's wrong. So in our law, how we break down law questions in school, tell the story, tell them what's wrong and then what you should do and how to move forward.
Yeah.
So that was the whole idea. I think I got up to 5 episodes out, and then while I started it, and I said the book, they are now contradicting each other. And as I was wrapping up the book, I got there in life work. I moved from Enugu to Lagos. So everything was just happening so fast. And I never had time to, like, okay, sit down and think back. And then the moment I started thinking about going back to Dear Creators podcast, I was like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I need a co-host. I can't do this on my own, because me on my own, I don't say I'm a laid-back person, but I'm a chilled person. So most times, I always pick relaxation over stressing myself, especially if it's something that no other person is depending on me for. If it's a job and I have my clients pending, I can stress myself. But when I know it's me, and me, I can always say, oh, I will do it tomorrow. Let me watch TV. So I needed someone that will push me, remind me, oh, we needed to create content. We need to do this. You're doing podcasts on your own. Trust me. Kudos, because it's not easy to do it on your own. So many times, you don't want to quit. You just say, let you take a small break, and that is it. Otilo, it's gone.
Yeah.
And that's the end. So when I started saying, okay, I'm going to... I was considering Lola. Very strangely, we met via DM. I just sent her a DM. Oh, I'm in Lagos. I'm an entertainment lawyer. We're same set, law school, a court bar. Is it possible for us to meet? And she replied me in less than an hour. And that's how we met. And the beautiful friendship blows up.
That's amazing. And I hope go ahead.
When I was thinking about it, I didn't know she was thinking about something like that. She wanted to do a podcast, but at the same time, she needed a co-host. So literally, before she beat me to it, before I could ask her if she could be my co-host, she reached out to me. I was like, oh, that she's thinking that we should do a podcast or something, like, not really like online, leave Instagram, like do something outside Instagram. So at first I was like, should I play cool? I'm not really thinking about this. And then we now had like a business meeting, met up, had lunch. And I was like, sincerely, I was really considering this. I was like, I already have a podcast. So she was like, considering what she was proposing was a different approach. She wanted us to look at law on a wider spectrum, not just entertainment law. So I was like, okay, because of that, I can't do Dear Creators. So we now said, okay, fine. Since we're doing this, we could leave Dear Creators on its own and then form a new podcast. So that was how Legal Avenue Podcast.
Now, to your point thank you for sharing that. Now, to your point about how lawyers, even professionals, there's a lot of backlash that people share or have when it comes to whether you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, who are using their clients as examples on social media. Mm-hmm. And people are like, why are you exposing that person? Even if you say it's person A. But people say that for people who know that person, they can connect the dots. So when you talked about Dear Creator podcast and you're talking about, you know, what they've gone through, do they have an issue with that?
So the thing is, for example, for the podcast, I reached out to a few people. I was like, oh, this could come up. I'm not using your name. It's just when you hear story. And for them, they were excited because they're like, oh, I want these people to learn from this. But generally, we know that there's the attorney client privileges and communication and certain things you can say. So I personally, I don't think there's anything wrong with using an example. It's an experience of yours. Mm-hmm. But definitely when it's still so fresh, there's some G's that are so fresh that no matter how you mask it as example, people will know who you're talking about. Give it time. Let it rest, let it settle. Maybe so someone like me now, if I want to start using informations I know to teach people, this 2023, I'm going to go back to 2019 and pick information from 2019. Mm-hmm. Probably people have moved on from it. Or even mix it up. You must not give the fact as it is. You're using it as an example. So put in salt, pepper, cook it well. So even when the person you're saying reads the story, they're like, oh, this is me. Oh, no, this didn't happen. I don't think this is me.
Yeah.
So you can always keep it up. But when you make it so obvious, no matter how much you mask it, there's some G's that's still too fresh. They will know who you're talking about. Those ones are wrong.
Okay. That makes sense. All right, let's go on to the fun random questions. You ready? You guys are ready now.
All right.
First question is, who's your favorite dancer or choreographer?
Guys, I love you all. I'm not playing favorites. If I don't answer, what will happen? Nothing, right?
It has to be answered. It's a simple question. Favorite dancer?
I have choreographers as clients. It's not be as if I like one more than the other.
Just say all my clients. We move on to the next question.
All of them.
Okay.
You're all amazing.
You're all amazing.
You guys are great.
Okay. Second question is, what was the last book that you read?
So the last book I read was a reread. I reread The Weight by Devon Franklin and Megan Good.
Okay.
I know they are separated, but I love the book.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, just because something doesn't work, it doesn't mean that the message is not
valid. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, third question is, if you had the opportunity to japa to one of the following countries, which one are you picking? Ghana, Switzerland, or Rwanda?
Two are African.
I know.
One is outside Africa.
Wait.
I don't understand.
Wait.
Is that a question?
Well, I heard that Rwanda... I have been to Rwanda.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, it is. But I repeat, two are Africans and one is
an African podcast. We have to support
each other. Okay.
Off camera. Oh, yeah. Is it okay?
But Rwanda, I'm coming to you.
Okay. All right. Rwanda it is. Fourth question is, what are two things that people do not know about you?
So, number one is a lot of people see me as, you know, very out there, very serious, very hardworking. Trust me, I just want to rest. I just want to sleep. You know what I mean? That's almost, if your text message didn't come in this morning, I'd have seen it as a sign from God. Oh my
God. Thank God I did.
When your text message came in and I went to LinkedIn, I was like, oh, shoot. I was really excited.
Yeah, that I she kind of said it. I kind of, because I was like, I haven't heard from her. So I was like, you know, let me just text her in the morning. Thank God I did.
So that's one. Two, I think I've said this before, but if I was not a lawyer, I'd be an actor, an actress. Me and film industry, we have.
But you never know, like, life is still, you know.
I know, I'm not.
You're not going
to. I know. I like where I am.
All right. Final question is, if you had the opportunity to do life over, what is one skill or gift that you'd make sure that you had or that you have?
I think probably coding.
Coding?
Yeah. I've been a badass coder.
Okay.
If that's a word.
Well, that's great. I love that. That's interesting. Yeah. Now, any last words before we wrap it up?
I think the last word, I've mentioned this before, but in as much as you don't like it, see yourself as a product. Some people have cracked that. See yourself as a business. Don't be sentimental. When I say entertainers or artists can be emotional, I wasn't saying like, oh, don't have emotions. No, I'm saying that they can get sentimental about certain things. You want to do a business and then you hear, oh, it's my friend, I trust him. It's business. Leave sentiment aside. We're still friends, but don't mix the both. So I think the general thing I would say is treat yourself as a business. Treat yourself as a product. Take yourself seriously. However you think a product should act, protecting their rights, protecting their work, improving on their work, do all of that. And have a good team. Don't have people that will lie to you. Have a good team.
Yeah. And for people who want to keep up with the work that you're doing, whether it's your nuggets.
My handles across all social media platforms is at Mandy Uzawa.
That's great. Thank you so much for your time, Amanda.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a few minutes to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. It helps the show get discovered by more people. Thank you. This episode is produced and edited by Fola Shade Anosie. Executive producers for this episode are Sandra Oyewole and Ajibola Olomola. Theme song is by John Akinola. You can check out the podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at the SNC Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.